Bingo.
Okay. All right, then.
So Casey, here we can start.
All right, so we're going to just take a little bit of a running start. We're not going to have time to do a whole lot of reviewing, but just a little bit of a running start. You know,
let me see if I can go. Never mind.
We're not going to. So, you know, this portion of Revelation is, and how we started the book, and I know that how I look at the latter part of the book is somewhat unique. I'm not dogmatic about it, because I don't know that you can afford to be dogmatic about it. But we've been fighting the urge to jump to the end of time, right? So we've been trying to interpret it as what it would mean to John's first readers. How it, you know, there's many people that would say the mark of the beast is Adolf Hitler, right? So and some, they've written books about that. And, I was telling Russ that the harlot, one guy went through a whole long dissertation that it was Dallas, Texas, was the city that he was referring to. I said, well, as long as it's not Tuscaloosa or Columbus, and personally, I think it's Ann Arbor. And kind of what I think it is. But so there's all this conjecture, but it all jumps, you know, so around chapter 19, around the middle of chapter 19, where that massive description of Armageddon takes place, which it doesn't, people jump to the end of time without warning, whatever. And that may be right. I'm not saying that 19, 20, 21 is not a description of final judgment. It may very well be. And final judgment and then what heaven is like. It may very well be that. To say that would not encourage John's first readers would be wrong, because it's encouraging to us to look forward to a heavenly home, I think. So that would not be a correct way to look at that. But we've been fighting against that urge, primarily because a lot of false teaching comes from jumping back and forth to the end of time frequently to prove some sort of point, some sort of doctrine that they want to get across. And so we've been trying to fight that as best as we can. We're going to continue to go that. I just think, for me personally, I think it makes more sense when I read through this that it applies to John's first readers. There's eternal applications for us. Please don't, and we'll try to draw those out as we go. But that's my impression of what this book is all about. And so we've been fighting that urge as best as we can. But then we get to this section, you know, where, you know, and a good, Michael asked a good question about the 1,000 years and what happens after the 1,000 years. We're going to try to get to that as best as we can. But then you hear all those phrases and you read it, and it does sound confusing. I will admit that this section is some of the more difficult portions in Revelation to understand and figure out what it might mean to John's first reader. So you had the sea beast, the Roman Empire, was destroyed. You have the earth beast, both of which we saw in chapter 13. The false prophet was destroyed. Imperial city of Rome is destroyed. We see those that worship the beast, the kings, the captains, the men, the horses, all everything is. So you see enemies of God's people are methodically, one by one by one, being dealt with and taken out of the way, so that God's people don't have to worry about them anymore. And we'll have to backtrack that a little bit, what it means to take them out of the way. We'll have to discuss that a little bit more. So, you know, everything Roman that's hostile to Christians is destroyed. You know, the statement, "it is done," from Revelation 16, is repeated in this text. The empire, the military, the religion, economic, all those things have been dealt with. And so God's people can then flourish. The only thing left to deal with is the power behind all of that. Now we got to get rid of, you know, because what we've done is we've treated some symptoms here. Now we got to go after the disease. And that's what John is going to detail out. Oh, I forgot. So apparently Christ will return on May 21st. So this is an old article, although it was in 2011. So we were not raptured, I guess, is how you would look at that.
And the Davises are here. They went to McDonald's and ordered one hamburger, two cheeseburgers, no fries. Well, no wonder they got that number as their number, 666. So that was their number, and they weren't real crazy about picking up the food.
Number 666, coming to order.
They weren't real crazy about getting that. They didn't know if it's edible or not. It has nothing to do with 1,000 years, but I thought it was very entertaining. So all of these things take place in chapter 20. So that's the kind of thing that we want to deal with. We went through this before, this chart, but I want to backtrack on it just a little bit. So you have this binding of Satan that takes place in verses 1 through 3. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand a key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years was ended. And after that, he must be released for a little while. And that same kind of phrase is repeated 2 more times in the text. So the binding of Satan takes place and he's thrown into this bottomless pit. But we've seen the bottomless pit before, haven't we? We've seen it 3 different times in Revelation. And it's not, so things are coming out of the bottomless pit periodically throughout Revelation. None of it is ever good. Whatever is coming out of that bottomless pit is not a good thing, and it's bad for the saints. But what does it mean to bind Satan? What does that mean? I think that's maybe the word that I did not delve into very thoroughly. What does it mean to bind Satan?
You're referring to the first part of chapter 20?
Yes, I am. That bound him for 1,000 years.
Limited in some ways.
Okay, limited in some ways. Okay, and I think that's correct. Any other? What has been the main problem from chapter 1 on? What has Satan been doing from chapter 1 on?
Interfering.
Using what?
Using the nations.
Using the nations. In
Rome.
When I look at it, it's Rome. Yeah. Right? Government. He is using Rome to torture and kill and tempt and persecute his people. And he's been deceiving the nations to believe that Caesar is God. He is the great deceptor. That has been what he's doing. And so, binding Satan, to me, means he can't do that anymore. I go back to one slide. I've already taken care of the sea beasts. I've taken care of the earth beasts. I've taken care of the kings and the men and the armies and the horses. I've dealt with all of that. And now I'm going to get rid of Satan. He can't use Rome anymore to hurt me. And that, to me, so when he's bound, he is perfectly bound in that way. He is working through Rome to persecute his people, to deceive the people of the earth that Caesar is, in fact, God. So that binding is that. It isn't, what we would think is binding is that you're, again, totally incapacitated. And I think that word when or until or after comes into play here. Because is Satan, because this will come up multiple times, so if he's bound and he can't use the Roman Empire, does that mean we don't have to pay attention to him? Well, how did Paul describe Satan in Ephesians 6 in talking about putting on the full armor of God?
Hurling arrows.
You better have that shoe. You got to have it all to defend yourself against all of the fiery darts and the bad things that are going to come happen. You can't take Satan, for he is bound forever. Daniel says forever, John says 1,000 years. He is bound for, he'll never be able to use Rome, and he's never been able to use a government like Rome since, quite frankly. I don't think that's what the text is saying, but he's never been able to use Rome. And God's people knew that, and they knew that there was a time of peace coming. And you could look throughout Isaiah and see the exact same things happening in I think chapter 55 or 56. Then you turn to the end of the book in chapter 65 and 66. It's the same kind of language being used
throughout those texts as well regarding what kind of environment God is creating for his people. Now that I've taken care of Babylon, now that I've wiped them out, they are no longer a concern of yours. Let me tell you about the environment that you're going to flourish in. And that's, to me, what we're about to see in chapter 21 especially. But he's still in the process of destroying our Babylon, or at least John's readers' Babylon. So then you have this binding of Satan for 1,000 years, the reign of the martyrs for 1,000 years is taking place as well, which is the first resurrection. Again, Daniel is going to say forever. Here, we'll look at some of those texts. In verses 7 through 10, all of God's enemies and people are thrown into the lake of fire. At that point, it's, you know, they've all been dealt with. And that lake of fire is, again, something that we have seen over and over again in our studies, especially of the Old Testament. I mean, God often describes his destruction of nations in talking about fire. They will, you know, the smoke will ascend forever and ever, a fire that cannot be quenched. Never really literally happens, maybe in Sodom and Gomorrah's case it did, but it according to Jude, it's still burning today, but it's not literally, it's not burning today, but it was destroyed with fire. And the same thing with Assyria, same thing with Edom, same thing with Egypt, the same language, this lake of fire, although lake of fire is only found in Revelation. There is unquenchable fire, fervent heat, other descriptions of that kind of punishment that go on. So then you have this whole Gog and Magog thing. Again, I think Satan is bound. He can't use Rome any longer to hurt you. You don't have to worry about Rome ever again. But you can't take him for granted. It's not like he's dead. He's still out. He's still deceiving. He's still doing those things. He's not done, and that's where Gog and Magog come in. If you go back to Ezekiel 37 and 38, you read those passages, and that's where you see Gog and Magog. Their objective was to attack the holy city in Ezekiel. The objective here is to attack the people of God, the holy city. What God is saying here is, I've dealt with Rome. You don't have to worry about Rome anymore. I've dealt with any attack that Satan is going to throw at you. I have dealt with it. You don't have to worry about that. You have to be cautious. And I you know, from my brain, I go to Romans 7 and 8. You know, Paul's struggle with temptation. The things I don't want to do, I do. The things that I do want to do, I don't do. That ongoing inner struggle that Paul has with his temptations. And then he gets to chapter 8, and it's still, I mean, it's a depressing chapter on the very first part because of the persecution and the suffering that happens, and then all of a sudden he goes, nothing can separate us from the love of God. We are more than conquerors because we love God, because we can't be separated. Same message here that John is trying to give to the people that are reading his letter. You are more than conquerors if you hold close to him. That seems to be the message. Satan's still dangerous, but he can't hurt you. I mean, it really was. It's hard for us to visualize it. But the kingdom of God was on the verge of collapse because of Rome. He was going to kill everybody that wore the name of Christ. That they were just going to die. And those that were left were starting to compromise because we can't fathom the kind of torture that was going on. We just can't. I mean, would you allow your daughter to die if you could at all prevent it? If you would just tell a lie and say, Caesar's God, and that would stop your daughter from being killed in front of you. How many of us wouldn't be tempted, at least, to make that compromise? So the kingdom was about to be destroyed. But God's promise to Daniel reigns true, and he would not allow that to happen. And this letter had to be delivered because the people of God are on the verge of giving up. And the Lord is saying, don't give up. Hold my hand. We can get through this. Because the kingdom will never fail. The kingdom is established forever, as I promised. It will always be there. So that, to me, is the main message throughout this. Gog and Magog is something that you just can't take for granted. And then the scene at the latter part, 11 through 15, of the great. The books are opened. the rest of the dead, that little passage right there, so the dead that did not come back to life, to me, that's the other dead. So you have, he's mostly dead. So you have this one dead that is Princess Bride, is that what you just said? Yes, so. Yes, I can't get away with anything. So you have the dead that remained faithful to God. They were raised. Those that were beheaded for the word of God, that they're described in this chapter. They were because they would not sacrifice on the testimony. They wouldn't compromise. They are raised. But the rest of the dead weren't raised until right now. Then now they're because they're wicked, because they served the beast. They served the devil. Now they are going to be judged. And this is the second resurrection. The books are open. They're going to be judged according to their works. The sea gave up its dead. The death and Hades gave up everything. And all of them are going to be judged. And they are going to be thrown into the lake of fire. They're going to suffer the second death at that point. So, that's kind of a huge overview with regard to everything that is going on. So we get back to this binding of Satan business. Again, it's this whole 1,000 years does not and can't refer to a time period per se. It is a state of things. It's 10^3 power. So 10 is a human completeness number.
I really thought about that a lot on Sunday after class, and even though we might take a different interpretation, mm-hmm. I think that what we're both saying is that the 1,000 years represents a completeness of God's purpose.
Yes.
If his purpose is to defeat Satan's ability to use Rome, then he's doing that for 1,000 years. In the completeness of his purpose, he's bringing that purpose to accomplish. If you take the more eternal view, then it's still his purpose for earth. But I think when we talk about years and time, you're right. It's not just, that's your stopwatch.
Right.
It's not a measure of time, but it seems to be the completeness of God's purpose.
The ten is 10 fingers and 10 toes. A child is said to be complete, said to be whole. And so you put that to the third power. Well, that is, from a human perspective, that is the epitome of fullness and completeness and perfection. This binding for 1,000 years, and I like Summer's commentary on this. The triumph is pictured in various scenes: the fall of the imperial Rome, the fall of Roman allies, the fall of the municipal Rome, and the rejoicing of the saints, the disposal of the two great enemies, the beast and the false prophet. The complete disposal of the third, the devil, remains and is finally effected in the 10th verse of chapter 20. The verses which follow that describe the judgment of those who had listened to the devil and the complete triumph of the Christians in their union with Christ, these considerations are themselves sufficient to show that the overthrow of Satan and not the reign of 1,000 years is the main theme of the first 10 verses of this chapter. You know, the whole thing is about our reigning. I think it's a perfect quality of things. I don't think it's a period of time because, again, I don't see how you can make it a time period at all without it affecting what Daniel promised us. And I could be wrong on that. I just don't see it. Maybe, Philip, you have a way to round that to make it a period of time?
No,
I don't know.
You're saying it's the completeness of his purpose to defeat Rome. I think it's the completeness of the purpose of all creation.
Okay.
And now creation is getting wrapped up, and he's moving into eternity.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
But it's still a completeness of purpose.
It is a completeness of purpose. And even though you're wrong, that would still... And what Philip is saying is correct. You can go to the end of time, and again, I would say to say that that is not encouraging is false. Because it is encouraging to look to the end of time and God wrapping everything up and saying... Here's the eternity that I've prepared for you. That to me is very encouraging. So I'm not discounting that at all.
But the interpretation is what we're trying to get, which is 1,000 years.
Yeah.
It's not 1,000 years in Jerusalem and
right.
some earthly
oh, no.
reign.
Right.
It's a completeness of his purpose, whether that's Rome.
Right.
Or, but it's a completeness of purpose.
It is. But at the bottom line, that is correct.
I think we can say when it started and when it ended with some You know, we can't say that 1,000 years is 1,000 years.
Right.
It's we know it's after Rome, right? So we know 1,000 years started after Rome was removed as an influence. Okay? And then Satan was found, right? Mm-hmm. So we know that that is the beginning of 1,000-year period, whatever it is.
Yeah, that sounds like a time thing to me.
I'm on the time.
Yeah.
And then we know it ends,
so,
or aligns somewhat with when Jesus ends his reign, which means he's going to soon get rid of death, which is the last item.
Right.
Right? And then he's going to hand the kingdom over to God the Father. Right? So we know that it ends before he hands the kingdom over. Which, in a way, is
right.
The completeness of...
Yeah, I struggle with... Then is Daniel wrong with saying forever? That in the days of those kings, in the days when Rome was there, that's my interpretation of Daniel 7 and Daniel 2. When Rome is done and he takes care of that empire, that king, which is the empire, then God will establish his kingdom forever and ever and ever and ever. Amen.
Right. The kingdom is going to last forever.
Right. But it talks about the reigning, that the saints will reign with all of that in the same text in Daniel. But so there's this idea of reigning.
What about 1 Corinthians 15 where it talks about... Here, I'll just read it. I've got to find them again.
We only have 58 verses.
I know it's chapter 15. For God is, you know, he puts all things in subjection under his feet, but when it says all things, you put that, and then it says, once all things are put underneath his feet, then he's going to deliver. There it is.
Right.
Then comes the end when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and every power. And the last enemy destroyed is death, which Revelation tells us exactly when that happens in the narrative, right? Doesn't give us a date, but it does say this happened.
Maybe not. Maybe not.
Okay.
I don't think it does. So,
you don't think Revelation?
It says that there will be no more death, but he said the same thing in Isaiah when Israel, Judah, made a covenant with death. They made an alliance with Assyria. They made an alliance with Egypt, and so the scripture says they made an alliance with death. You made a covenant with death, and you're going to regret that. And the reason he called Assyria death, he personified death as Assyria, because they had the power of life and death. Just by the tip of the scepter, you die in that age. And so it, multiple times it is the fact when he says, I will take care of Babylon and there will be no more death.
Well,
I will take care of Assyria and there will be no more death.
In the last class, I think you gave some examples of when forever was not really forever. Right.
Well,
I think you gave some examples.
There's a... I don't know that I would. 1,000 isn't me at 1,000. I did say that. Like, these passages where, you know, 1,000 generations is not 1,000 generations. 1,000 cattle is not 1,000 cattle. I did that. I don't know that I would say it forever. It's not forever.
Look, but in 2014, then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death fire, right? So...
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking that.
Yes, that as the end of time.
No longer exists, and death no longer exists.
Right. And you may be right. You in fact may be right. I don't read it that way. I still think that Rome had the power of death, and when I take away Rome, you know, because it says, I will wipe away every tear from every eye. Well, if that's heaven, why are you still crying? You know, you're still crying. God's going to comfort you is what it says. So, I just don't see that as a heaven thing. And even after that, when he describes what we typically look as heaven, there's still multiple invitations, and the gates will never be closed, and the nations could come into it. They gotta purify themselves, but the nations can still come into this wonderful city new heaven and new earth that came down from heaven, right? So it came from heaven to earth. So that's how I look at that. So, you know, there's all these other examples. But hey, 1,000 doesn't always mean 1,000. So, and then here's, you know, all the different verses of they will endure forever, they possess the kingdom forever. The saints of the Most Highest will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. So again, I don't see there's an end to that. I think the kingdom was established on the day of Pentecost, and it will last forever and ever and ever and ever, and will never end. At the end of time, whether it's listening to what Peter says or Paul says, at the end of time, the Lord is going to present us as a pure bride. And he'll hand it over to the Father in heaven, like in 1 Corinthians 15. But that doesn't mean the reigning stops, ever. You know, I can't imagine a time. So if you look at this, here's the different verses, right? So you have 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, all there, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times thousands, right? And then all these after that or until and when come up, I think, at that point, right? For me, if Daniel and John are in harmony with one another, and that so 1,000 and forever would mean exactly the same thing. Is that a safe assumption? No. So, okay.
It's a very legitimate possibility.
Okay. That's where I struggle, because I don't see any other conclusion to make. That Daniel says the kingdom will be established in the days of those kings and it'll last forever, and the saints will reign with it. John is saying it's going to last for 1,000 years.
I don't know that we're saying anything different. I don't
okay.
Know.
Okay, then I'm missing something.
The saints in the kingdom,
right,
can reign, which is the kingdom can exist forever.
Uh-huh.
I think we all agree that that's
right. True. There's never a time that...
And the saints can reign.
Uh-huh.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only element that we may be disagreeing about is how long will Christ reign. Right, so at some point, Christ, according to 1 Corinthians 15, he's going to hand it over to the Father. And death, well, we'll go there yet.
Right, right.
I would express it slightly. The kingdom is here.
Mm-hmm.
Christ is already reigning. It really happened in the Empire of Rome. That's what Daniel's all about.
Right.
But there will come a time when there is a change to all of that. That's what 1 Corinthians 15 is about.
Correct.
So then the question is just, is the end of chapter 20 into chapter 21 about that time? Or is it just a continuation of the same thing throughout the rest of the book of Revelation? I don't see anything that says either interpretation can't be the one.
Okay.
The reading of it sounds a lot more to me like it's describing 1 Corinthians 15,
okay,
turning over the kingdom, the end of death, the resurrection, and all of that to wind up the book.
Right.
But I don't see anything that says it can't be what you're saying either.
Right.
It would still fit the theme of the book.
Okay.
I just don't see the contradiction at all from Daniel.
Yeah, I take it as... That I can't fathom, and all the verses just get, I can't fathom a time that Christ isn't reigning forever and ever. You know, even when the end of time comes.
That's okay, but still there is a change in 1 Corinthians 15.
Sure.
So I mean, however you want to describe it, I wouldn't say Christ stops reigning necessarily, but there is some other end point. The resurrection hasn't happened yet. That is something that's
which one?
Coming.
The first or second? I'm joking.
Well, the second death, I think, right, you know, is the idea of some in the resurrection,
right,
will die in a different way. That to me is
what, right, and I don't know that either of those resurrections is what John is referring to in this case. And when he talks about the different resurrections that are available to
him.
Okay. Again, I look at this as, you know, those other words like until and after and when. I look at those, if forever and 1,000 mean the same thing, then those other words must mean something different than what we would typically define them as in English, if you will. They can't mean the conclusion of one thing and the beginning of another.
Well, and if we stick with the idea that this is still just painting a picture, it's telling a story, and there's a lesson in that story,
right?
Right? That you would describe something as a series of events to amplify the major theme of the book, even if you don't intend the series of events in your, let's call it a parable for a moment, if you don't intend the series of events in your parable to exactly line up to a chronological series of events or judgment.
Right.
They don't have to be one for one in this book.
Okay.
They don't.
Okay. You and I might need to talk about that because I'm not sure I'm fully following.
That's fine. So,
okay. All right.
I'm trying to help. But
I know you are, and I appreciate that.
Well, maybe I'll just make a broader observation. Sometimes biblical language, it's just not precise, right? And it gets the point across, but not in the way that, you know, when I write something, man, every single word has to be literally 100%, you know, no dispute about it. You know, so take 2 Samuel 7, for instance. God says that there will always be a descendant of David on the throne. Well, if you looked in 200 B.C., you'd say, well, what was that talking about? There used to be one, and now there's not. Well, but when you look in the course, but now we sit back and look back, we say, well, Jesus is reigning, right? Like, it clearly is fulfilled. And the same thing is true with the 1,000 years, right? If you came up to me, say you were baptized on the day of Pentecost, and say, you're starting a kingdom today that will last 1,000 years. Actually, it will last at least 2,000 years. And you say, I can't imagine. What does that even mean? Like, that's the same thing as forever.
Right.
But
it is.
You know, like, to our limited minds, those are the same thing. And God speaks in ways, sometimes that, you know, if you were to, okay, maybe that's different things, but he gets his point across to us.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think to John's first reader, saying 1,000 years is forever to what they were going through right now, because they can't. Their children are dying. They're thrown into an arena with lions. Terrible things are happening. And so to tell them they're going to reign with Christ for 1,000 years is beyond my comprehension.
So do you kind of take verse 8 to be that this he's reigning forever because Rome has been fully defeated, but there will be other nations, Gog and Magog, whatever that means. Be other nations that will give us difficulty in the course of human history. Is that how you're taking Gog and Magog?
I would say that Gog and Magog stand for any attempt that Satan will use, any circumstance that Satan can turn to his advantage to attack us and to tempt us and to do those things that are contrary to God's will. I don't know that it could be other nations. It could be. But I think it's any attempt that they make, that Satan makes, he will be defeated. Nothing can stop that.
Right.
That's how I take verse.
Yeah, because I see Gog and Magog from Ezekiel as like total defeat.
Yes.
They have no chance standing against God whatsoever.
Right, and the same thing. Well, fire comes down and consumes them in verse 9. So they're, again, the same. They meet the same fate as the Gog and Magog did in Ezekiel's day. So totally didn't answer everybody's questions on that. I tried a very feeble attempt to say this little while is just a comparison. It's a quality thing. It is, so you have 1,000 years versus a little while. It's like 3.5 days or 3.5 years. That's, you know, how long the things that would go on is very weak, very ineffective compared to the forever or the 1,000 years that's described that. But again, I still think it's beyond Gog. That's where the Gog and Magog thing come in. Is that so? I think the whole binding is that of Satan not able to use Rome anymore. That from my perspective, you know, all of chapter 20 gets into that defeat of that last enemy of God's people and taking him out of the way so that he can't destroy us like he did back then. Any other questions? I really hesitate to even ask that question. Okay. Anything else that I've really muddied up before we go to the last two chapters that we're clearly not going to finish here? And comparatively, I find chapters 19 and 20 easier to explain than 21 and 22. You know, because again, I don't view that as heaven. You know, I don't view that as a story or description of what heaven is going to look like. You know, the precious jewels and gems, and for the most part, it's because I see that same language repeated over and over again in the prophets. He made the same promise to Isaiah about a precious city, ornate. Highly decorated with precious gems and jewels. Same kind of thing. And it's still the idea of I'm taking care of your enemy, now I'm creating an environment of peace, an environment where you can flourish and you can serve me like you want to. You don't have to worry about these enemies anymore. But just, you know, great language that you have here and picking up in verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven and from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. And he who is seated on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. Also he said, Write this down, for the words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give a spring of water, a water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for the murderers and the sexually immoral, as sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. So you have tremendous language that's going on here. You have, you know, what we've been seeing is, you know, the judgment on God, how God attacks when he says, when he destroys a nation, when he takes them out of the way, he basically describes that as saying, I have destroyed their world. So when Babylon fell, their world collapsed in on top of them. When Rome fell, we already saw the wailing and the weeping by all the people that depended on her for their livelihood. They wailed. They were missed. Their whole world just collapsed. How am I going to make a living? How am I going to provide for my family? Rome is now gone. I can't sail over to Rome anymore. There's nothing there. It's collapsed. So you have all of this dismantling of the oppressor's world. But on the opposite side, so if this is what he does to his enemies, the opposite side is just the opposite of all of that. Rivers that flow from deserts, soil that bears fruit abundantly, constantly, never-ending bearing of fruit, hills and mountains, they just drip with milk and honey and all those wonderful things that happen. You go back and read Isaiah 65 and 66. Former troubles are gone. He creates new heaven and new earth. He creates Jerusalem a rejoicing. So, the whole thing, it's all pointing to what he's done to Babylon. I'm taking it out of the way for you. So this is what you get. You have a new place to thrive in. And that's the beauty of that whole kind of contrast. Now, you see throughout Revelation a series of contrasts. Feasts where birds feast on flesh. And then you have a bridal feast as well, a marriage feast that's going on. You look at the descriptions there. These are God's people. The one thing that you can constantly see, these are God's people. God is going to take care of them. No more tears, no more death, no more sorrow, no mourning, no crying, no pain. I am taking care of you. I've created this environment. I've dealt with your enemies. This is what you have to look forward to. And for us, this kind of vision of this kind of environment ought to make us want other people to come into this same city that we are in possession of. We ought to be eager to tell other people, eager to evangelize and tell people about this great, marvelous city, that about being God's people. And it's, again, this whole contrast that you see here. It is a satisfied people. If you're thirsty, I'll give you a spring of water without payment. If you're from an overcoming standpoint, there is nothing you can't accomplish if you stay with me. I will give you a heritage. You will be I will be your God, and you will be my son. To me, all this whole thing talks about is fellowship. The bond between father and son here is going to get even tighter, because God has proven his love. He is over and over again. He's taking care of us, and all the bad stuff, I think, is taken away from us. You have newness, the new heaven and new earth. You know, that same phrase is used multiple times. To me, I think it's a new environment for the church. It's new because it's divine in nature. Because it comes down out of heaven. It doesn't rise from the earth. Like all the bad things in Revelation that we see, they all come from the earth or from the sea. Anything that comes out of heaven is good and has to do with God's people. You know, the description of this city is beyond imagination. Gold street, jeweled walls. It's just beauty. It describes something that is beyond description. It is, the purity of it is a bride dedicated to the groom. Four square, high walls, the stability of it, the strength of this city. It can never fall. Based on everything that they've been through, to know that they're going to dwell in a city like this, that has these walls and these gates, the difference for them had to be incredible. I think I skipped it here. Oh, the light, the importance of, the light. Again, in Isaiah 60, the sun shall no longer be your light by day, nor the brightness shall the moon give light to you, but the Lord will be to you an everlasting light, and your God your glory. And he goes on and on with that. Again, same language John is pulling from Isaiah and giving it to his readers, saying, you won't need a light. God is your light from now on. And that is the same promise that was given. You have gates that are there. Holiness is separated from evil. You have gates that are always open. Gates that never close. And again, Isaiah 60 says the same thing. Yeah.
I just, for the class, it's easy to read these chapters and go, no, I don't think I agree with Larry. I think it's probably heaven. Look,
right.
Until you get up to teach one of these classes, and you have to come face to face with Isaiah's language, and you go, you know what? I have to hesitate. I have to pause. Because it is so similar to Isaiah's language. You know what I mean? Like that, I don't like to just to see it from both sides. And
yes,
unless you stood up and taught an adult class on Revelation, and had to be ready to say, am I sure that Isaiah's language is only talking about the future or only talking about the glory of the church? That is a hard, hard thing to do. So I think the weight of Isaiah's language here should really weigh on people as we read this chapter.
I will strongly encourage you to go back and read Isaiah 65, 66. Because I just think you look at that, and even Isaiah chapter 60. I think when you read through those things, it's a very compelling. A very compelling story.
It makes you slow down.
Yeah. I was thinking about calling in sick and making Russ teach.
So, Larry, the end of chapter 20, 11 through 15.
Are you back in 20? You won't let me get out of 20. Yes.
Yes or no?
Yeah.
Yes.
No.
That's not the final judgment?
No. No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Again, if this was a 26 lesson class, I would go into the Old Testament passages that deal with that same thing, where we're going to open up the books and we're going to judge. So the same kind of text that we're seeing. Yes?
And maybe this should be a lesson to us on, this is an early church, but they are so steeped in the Old Testament scriptures that they understand what John's talking about.
Yes.
Because I think sometimes we know, okay, I can turn to Isaiah 65 and 66, but I read it in light of how I've been, taught to see Revelation 21 and 22. And so I'm not actually seeing it in the full context of the 66 chapters of Isaiah, because
right.
I don't read those very often.
Right, right.
This, the early church did, and they understood those things.
They did.
So they really spent time in all of God's Word. And so when
John just makes a casual reference to Isaiah 65 without even a passage reference. Thank you.
Because he says in Isaiah 65, new heavens and a new earth, and the voice of weeping nor crying will no longer be heard like it was heard in Babylon. You know, so again, I read those passages and I'm like, I can't escape the fact that he's dealing with a new environment. But anyway, but I'm close-minded, so we'll deal with that from that standpoint. We'll pick up kind of there, and then I'm hoping to kind of give an overview of what premillennialism is. So that you at least recognize some of the buzzwords that are associated with that teaching, if I have time. Thank you. Yeah.